History's not like something like math. It's something that can have potentially many right answers and many different perspectives and many different ways to look at things. And what that means is sometimes when you're taking a tour through the past, the guide that you have at the time is key. And you can take the same tour multiple times, but if you have a different guide, they'll point out different things, emphasize different things. How often have you read two different books on the same historical event and gotten different perspectives? The perspective of the storyteller matters. Whether you like history or not, if you care about things like bravery and wisdom and passion and larger-than-life characters and some of the most emotionally intense moments in the human experience, well, you've come to the right place and a chance to get a perspective from a different kind of historical tour guide. Daniele Bellelli is a university history professor, a writer, a martial artist, a philosopher, and it provides a very different sort of tour guide through the past than you normally encounter. In this tour, he'll be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
Welcome to episode 27 of History on Fire. Today, it's going to be part 2 of a 3-part series about the life of Jack Johnson. Before we start, a few announcements. First, if you are absolutely allergic to ads, there's an easy way to avoid that. Is if you join the Patreon for History on Fire, which is at patreon.com/historyonfire, for $5 or more a month, you will get ad-free versions of these episodes. If on the other hand you do not mind the ads, or you think you could actually pick up some tips regarding some great products that may be out there associated with History on Fire, then stick around for the next little bit as I give thanks to some of the people who keep us in business. The first folks I would like to thank are the sweet people from Flaviar. Flaviar is the world's largest online club of spirits enthusiasts. They have compiled an amazing collection of more than 15,000 spirits. And basically, people who join their membership, what they get is that every quarter, they receive a complimentary themed tasting box of spirits. So basically, you get kind of samplers of different anything, whiskey, bourbons, you name it, anything like that. You get to have a taste, see if you like it, and if you like it, then you can always order full bottles at members-only prices. But this is a cool way to get a feel for what it is that you do enjoy before you actually buy a full bottle. Also, once a month, Flaviar offers drinks straight from the vault. If it sounds cool, it's because it is. These are extremely rare and hard-to-find spirits, available to members only. They also do private bottlings, they do live events, they do all sort of cool things. So since Christmas is coming up, you may need a gift for somebody who does enjoy spirits, or for yourself. Check these guys out. Now, normally they have a waiting list, but they kind of arrange a roundabout way for us, for History on Fire listeners, to have access now. So if you go to flaviar.com/exclusive and use the coupon code HISTORY during checkout, that would be the way to have access to it. Let me slow it down and spell it. So that's Flaviar, that's flaviar.com/exclusive, and the coupon code is HISTORY. Thank you also to BlueApron.com. These guys have decided to sponsor us for the whole year. They actually have asked if I can do 15 episodes this coming year in 2018. So you guys, thanks to Blue Apron, will get a few more History on Fire episodes that I was planning on releasing. So that's good enough reason to thank them. But even better, the fact is that what Blue Apron provides is some seriously amazing food straight to your door. Great recipes, very easy to follow. And before, it's amazing. It's like even days when I don't feel like cooking, I'm not always sure I'm doing the greatest job. Anytime, just follow the recipe. You cannot mess it up. It's, I'm sure we can organize a contest to see if somebody can. But generally speaking, you really can't go wrong. The food comes out amazing. The variety is awesome. I've been loving Blue Apron so much. Very, very happy that these guys have renewed the sponsorship. Blue Apron is treating History on Fire listeners to their first dinner. $30 value if you visit blueapron.com/onfire. So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off with free shipping at blueapron.com/onfire. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Big shout out also to Brad Harris from the How It Began podcast, A History of the Modern World. Brad is probably the one historical podcaster who have the most legit academic credential. He has a PhD in the history of science and technology from Stanford University. The production quality of How It Began is really high, and the content is super interesting. My favorite episode so far has to be the one that details the transformation from wolves into dogs. That was great. I enjoyed that one a lot. The general focus of every episode is that it's really about the scientific, technological, and cultural advancements throughout history. One that I've listened to lately is one about the development of the internet, how we went from the very early experiments to having the full-on World Wide Web. And that's one of the things that he often does. He takes a topic and shows you how it has evolved to where it is today throughout history. So check it out. It's very intriguing to see how our humanity, where we started and where we are, and Brad takes us to that journey. So check him out on Apple Podcasts or anywhere where you happen to listen, or check out his website at howitbegan.com. And last but most definitely not least, the two companies that have been with me from day one, Onnit and Atsusara. If you go to onnit.com/history, you will receive an automatic discount on any of the products that Onnit carries. It would take a whole podcast just to go through their catalog, because they really have so much stuff, from supplements, workout gear, clothing. There's also a great section where there's Onnit Academy, where you get a lot of free information about working out and exercise. So check them out. You really can't go wrong. I would doubt that you can go through the entire website and not find something either you like or you find would make a good gift for somebody. So check them out at onnit.com/history. And speaking of great things, I've been sponsored by Atsusara before I even started History on Fire, when I had other podcasts, because I've enjoyed their stuff so much over the years. Like recently I was traveling over Thanksgiving, and every single bag every one of us was carrying was a Atsusara bag. They're great for travel, they're great for work. They have a computer bag, for example, that's perfect for, it's what I carry to work every day. Really high quality hemp gear. Check them out at dsgear.com. If you didn't catch any of the above websites, links are in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. But now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. When we left our story last, Jack Johnson had accomplished what no other black boxer had done in the modern era, winning the heavyweight championship. These had enraged white supremacists who were desperately looking for a shot at revenge. But Jack Johnson was too busy partying to worry about any of that. Author Denzel Batchelor has this to say. He said, "He had lived humbly. He had gone hungry. He had been turned out into the snow. He had waited on the mat till the great man of the National Sporting Club could find time to deign to take notice of him. Now it was all going to be different.
It was his turn to push cheap white trash off the sidewalks, to entertain the most voluptuous women to champagne and caviar, to ride in gold-plated cars, to flash a gold-toothed smile at the ward. So now it was party time. You know, we saw in episode one of this series, the long road that Jack Johnson took to winning the heavyweight championship. Now it was his time to enjoy. Sometimes when I think of the Jack Johnson story, I think of the song I've Never Picked Cotton, made famous by Roy Clark. But in my mind, it's always in the version Johnny Cash did, because everything is better when Johnny Cash did it. In one verse, the song goes like this. It says, "And it was fast cars and whiskey, long-legged girls and fun. I had everything that money could bring, and I took it all with a gun." This particular song is the story of an outlaw. The "took it all with the gun" part obviously didn't literally apply to the way Jack Johnson got everything that money could bring, but it was pretty close. Boxing, after all, was the closest legal thing to being an outlaw with a gun, in the sense that Johnson was able to use violence, in this case legally, or at least more or less legally, considering the questionable legal status of prize fighting. He had been able to use violence to open doors that would have otherwise remained firmly closed to someone born in his socioeconomic circumstances. That's how he got his gold. Along with these lines, Jack Johnson was seen as a sort of modern-day Robin Hood in some black communities. For people who are all too familiar with having doors shut in their face, opportunities denied, the story of Jack Johnson was inspiring. Here was a guy who was able to take the gold by breaking the rules, by destroying all those doors that were closing his face. So many people were able to vicariously live through him and enjoy a little bit of sense of self-satisfaction, even though they hadn't won anything. The fact that a black man had been able to do it inspired them all. But the same attitude that made him a hero among some people made him public enemy number one among others. And so we probably have to say something about the cultural context of the late 1800s, early 1900s in the US. At this time, aggressive moral crusaders ruled the day. These were people who were big fans of the idea that laws are to be passed to curb vice, and that state should compel everyone to behave morally. The question that morality may not be the same for everyone did not enter their minds. Morality in their minds had no subjective qualities. It was completely objective. There was their idea of morality and everything else, which was all equally sinful in their eyes. They were absolutely sure that they were right and everyone else who disagreed was wrong. These were the same people who had cracked down heavy on prostitution, campaigning for decades to enforce more strictly the more or less never enforced prostitution laws, eliminating the red light districts, which incidentally led to a rise in the spreading of STDs due to the lack of regulation in the prostitution business, the increase in the number of pimps, more violence against women, but none of them bothered them because, you know, these, after all, were the same people who were against finding a cure for syphilis, because in their mind, you know, that was God's judgment on people sinning. Their thing was, well, if you have no sex outside of marriage, you don't need to worry about sexually transmitted diseases. So it's only right that you do catch STDs if you have sex outside of marriage because you are being sinful and you deserve it. That was sort of their mindset. These were also the same people who wanted to ban alcohol, and in a few years they would be able to do that by pushing forward the amendment that would outlaw production of alcohol in the US. These were the same people who had campaigned to censor books for sexual content. Basically, what we're looking at is, you know, an organized militant form of Protestantism that was somewhat less extreme, but no different in goals than the kind of moralistic religious fundamentalism found in other parts of the world. Think of the morality police in Saudi Arabia or Iran, for example. And granted, these guys tend to take things a few notches up, but they weren't really that different in substance, only in degrees. In any case, feeling that urbanization was encouraging vice, their rationale was, you know, in a small town, everybody know your business, so you'll feel the community pressure to stick to certain standards of accepted morality. Whereas in a big city, there's more anonymity, it's easier, you don't have that kind of community pressure, so people in the city have more freedom, which in their eyes, that was a very bad thing, because that meant freedom to sin. So they felt that urbanization was ruining American culture. And so it was important to crack down and have the government intervene strongly to legislate morality by law. What does that Jack Johnson have to do with it? Well, Johnson was the perfect symbol of everything that moral reformers hated. He was seen as arrogant and lacking morality. He was seen as a living challenge to the existing order. Author Randy Roberts has this to say. He drank, supported prostitutes, and threatened the very social and racial order of America. He was not the type of man rural Anglo-Saxon Protestants felt comfortable with. Instead, he was a constant reminder of the powerful threat to the traditional American order. In other words, he was public enemy number one of Protestant morality and work ethic. He represented everything they wanted to stamp out of existence. He's openly flaunting a lifestyle, indulging in what moral reformers considered vice, enraged them. So he had a target on his back. And Johnson perhaps should have been worried, since these guys were very aggressive in their efforts and commanded the loyalty of millions of people. Johnson, however, was clearly not that worried, since he was openly traveling with Hattie MacLay, who was a white prostitute who was often with him. She had been with him in Australia and Canada already. So yet again, his relationships with women caused an incident with one of his managers. In this case, one of his main managers, Fitzpatrick, who had set him up with some of his most important matches so far, told him that he should not travel with a white woman such as MacLay. Johnson didn't take well Fitzpatrick's effort to dictate his choices and promptly fired him. The American press freaked out when they saw Johnson traveling with a white woman. When they visited Canada, the best hotel in Victoria refused them a room. They had to go to 5 other more hotels, and every one of them turned them down. In Galveston, they had planned a parade in his honor for winning the heavyweight title. But suddenly, upon hearing that he may bring a white woman to the state, Texas authorities had openly threatened to arrest him if he showed up, since interracial marriages were illegal. The people who had planned the parade said that they would have to cancel if he brought a white woman, so Johnson told them to screw themselves. In another more diplomatic moment, he tried to say that she was part black, which wasn't really true at all, but the general message still was, I'm gonna do things the way I want, and if you don't like it, well, that's just too bad. On a better note, he managed to find some of the money that he made by winning the heavyweight title. He used that to buy a house for his mom in Chicago. He also got a new manager, a guy by the name of George Little, who was kind of, I'm trying to find a polite way to say it, because he was somewhat of a gangster, but he was very well connected with the part of Chicago where, in a relatively small area, there were over 500 saloons and 500 brothels there. And that's the kind of place where Johnson was most at home. He was at home in the integrated criminal world of prostitutes, gamblers, brothels, saloons. Because this, maybe precisely because this was a place where criminality thrived, where normal laws and rules stopped being enforced, this was the kind of war that was actually more racially progressive than just about anywhere else in America. Integration happened in this kind of underworld before, like decades before, it spread to other parts of the United States. So not surprisingly, that's what where Jack Johnson liked to hang out. One place that caught Johnson's eye was the Everly Club. The Everly Club was the greatest brothel in Chicago, and one of the greatest in the country, catering only to the very wealthy and to celebrities. All prostitutes and customers there were white. The place was run by two sisters, Ada and Minna Lester, who later would take on the name of Everly, hence the Everly Club. They were two former actresses who had gotten into the brothel business. Their establishment was the most expensive anywhere. At a time when the average dinner could be bought for 50 cents, you had to spend over $50 to have dinner at the Everly Club. They had a library, an art gallery, fountains. You know, maybe not the things that normal people associate with brothels, but this was something more than just a place where prostitutes did business. It was also somewhat of a status symbol, was a VIP club. Chicago journalist Jack Late once said, "Minna and Ada Everly are to pleasure what Christ was to Christianity." Okay, you know, take into account a little bit of flair and exaggeration, but still, you get the vibe of the reputation of the place. Prospective customers had to send in their business cards so that the sisters could decide whether to accept them as clients or not. Jack Johnson had the money and he had the celebrity status, but what he didn't have was white skin. So that was a bit of a problem because the sisters would not allow any black people inside, no matter how rich or famous they may be. In March 1909, Jackson yet again managed to take down a door closed in his face, in this case the door to the Everly Club. He managed to get inside thanks to his manager, Little. As I mentioned, Little was a bit of a gangster who collected protection money from everyone in that district and then paid off the police to stay out of it. So, the sisters, as a favor to Little, they decide to let Jack Johnson in, but they refused him services. Meaning, yeah, you can come in and take a look, but that's as far as we're gonna go. However, once he was in, Johnson was able to convince three of the ladies working there to follow him to a hotel, and six more women came later as well. All of them were promptly fired from the brothel for having sex with Johnson. Among them was Belle Schreiber. She was 23 years old. She was the daughter of a policeman, who, however, decided she wasn't really feeling continuing the job she had studied and trained for, which was to become a stenographer, and she much preferred becoming a prostitute. Which may sound weird to some people, as many people would think that nobody willingly chooses prostitution. Well, that's simply not true. While there are clearly are a lot of people who are forced into it, there are clearly lots of people who end up there out of desperation, there are also people who choose the profession, and Belle Schreiber was apparently one of them. Both she and Hattie McClay were the main ladies following Johnson around. So here you have him not just dating one white woman, but two of them at the same time, and one of them the daughter of a policeman. I mean, had Johnson planned a way to make sure to raise the blood pressure of thousands of Americans, he really couldn't have come up with a better plan. But as he said, and I quote his words, "I always take a chance on my pleasures." Here is another quote from Johnson. "How utterly fantastic, when I was a boy, would have been the thought that I should someday be plunged into romances and love with white women, in defiance of the torgid and guarded customs. In a particularly funny moment, when a journalist asked him why white women like black men so much, and how was it possible that he could always manage to carry on so many affairs with them at the same time, Johnson offered his best imitation of a Zen koan as his answer, and he said, "We eat cold eels and think distant thoughts." Is that even an answer? I mean, what does that even mean? Ah, Johnson is funny. Since apparently all the women he was sleeping around with weren't quite enough, Johnson also got into a more serious relationship. He met a lady named Etta Duryea. By the way, I'm taking a complete guess on the last name. I have no idea how to pronounce it. It's D-U-R-Y-E-A. So let's call her Etta and let's stick with it. He met her at the horse races, which is something that Johnson enjoyed a lot. He loved going to see horses racing and gambling on it. This was a pretty popular pastime in the early 1900s United States. Etta was different from the other ladies that Johnson hanged out with. She was from a rich family. She was married to a white guy. She had just recently divorced. And for a change, she was not a sex worker. They became friends at first, but it wasn't long until she joined Johnson's harem. They were his, for lack of a better term, his harem, but I mean, I'm not really stretching it, I'm not exaggerating. These were several women who traveled and had sex with Johnson all the time, Belle and Hattie being the two main ones. Johnson was very into Etta, or at least as in love with a woman as he could be, which clearly didn't mean he would be sexually faithful, because that was just not something that he was that he would ever do for anybody. Partially because of this, he didn't pay attention to some obvious red flags regarding Etta's heavy depression and latent mental illness. Being with Johnson didn't make things easier for her. White people hated her. Most black people hated her too. Everyone stared at her in public. So she would spend most of her time in the relationship waiting for Jack, who in the meantime had many other women. So start with the fact that she was already fairly depressed by the time Jack met her initially. Add these kind of conditions, it would be no surprise to see that things don't get better for her. Let's look at what happens with Etta in a little bit, but first, let's discuss a little more Johnson's relationship with women. It would be hard to deny that it had an element of addiction there. If you want to be more charitable, we can at least say that women were very high up on his priorities, that's for sure. But he was really kind of addicted to them. As he wrote, "There have been countless women in my life. They have participated in my triumphs and suffered with me in my moments of disappointment. They have inspired me to attainment, and they have balked me. They have caused me joy, and they have heaped misery upon me. They have been faithful to the utmost, and they have been faithless. They have praised and loved me, and they have hated and denounced me. Always a woman has swayed me. Sometimes, many have demanded my attention at the same moment." In many ways, as the last comment indicates in his quote, Johnson's whole persona carried a sexual vibe. His very public affairs with multiple women at the same time are just one example of it. His devotion to sensual pleasure, not just sex, mind you, but also drinking, food, music, fast cars, all of it was part of how he lived. He represented the sensual hedonism that was the exact opposite of the Protestant work ethic so prevalent at the time. Author Randy Roberts has this to say: Johnson did not care. He had no use for the bourgeois values of thrift and respectability. That was not his world. Money was for spending, and at that exercise he was proficient. Johnson didn't hide any of it. If anything, he loved flaunting it. He didn't hide his affairs. And the tale goes that often in the presence of the press, when he was sparring in front of journalists, he would stuff his shorts to make it look like he was hung like a horse. As Randy Roberts wrote, sexuality was the essence of Jack Johnson, the driving force behind his success, and his power was perceived by white females and males. Among his other passions was his tendency to regularly speed in his car. The symbolism of his love for cars is really not that difficult to figure out. Since he had been a teenager, Johnson had been restless and constantly on the move. The thing he fought against most throughout his life was people trying to keep him in his place, so to speak. And Johnson was constantly trying to break loose, break free of the place reserved for black people in white America, break free of the roles other black people try to push on him. Again, in the words of author Randy Roberts, this is why the police and automobiles were so omnipresent in Johnson's mind. He rebelled against any symbol of authority, and often said he enjoyed nothing more than a fast car. Confinement was slavery for him, just as movement was emancipation. So by 1909, there were less than 500,000 cars in the United States, and Jack Johnson owned 5 of them. On one occasion, he demolished a car in an accident, walked away in one piece, and bought a new one the next day. Cops would give him tickets all the time, sometimes because he was truly speeding, sometimes just because they hated him. In one occasion, they even fined him for going too slow, which made Johnson say, "If I go fast, they arrest me, and now it seems like if I go too slow, they do the same." So, it's true that there was prejudice against him, there's no doubt. And it's true that cops love to pick, you know, the idea of a wealthy black guy flaunting his wealth got on the nerves of a lot of white cops. But in fairness, he rarely went slow. He just loved speeding. The anecdote with which I opened episode 1 of this series, I'll repeat it really briefly because it's so legendary and it kind of captures the vibe of it all. As I mentioned at the beginning of the first episode, once in Georgia, a policeman stopped him saying, "Where are you going so fast, boy? It's gonna cost you." And at this time, you could pay your fines in cash on the spot. So when the cop mentioned that it would cost $50, Johnson handed him $100. And when the policeman tried to protest, saying he didn't have change, Johnson just waved him off and said, "Don't worry, I'll be coming back the same way and I'll be driving at the same speed, so I'm just paying you in advance." That captures quite a bit the vibe that characterized him and his approach regarding driving cars. Despite this kind of bravado, despite his limited formal education and his well-deserved party animal reputation, Jack Johnson was also really smart. For one thing, he was very well read. He loved to read Edward Gibbon, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. He read everything he could about Napoleon. He was actually kind of obsessed with Napoleon. When he lived in France for a while, he visited his grave on a regular basis. He loved reading other authors like Alexandre Dumas, Victor Hugo. He was fascinated with the study of history, and he was also a very skilled musician. Particularly, one of his favorites was classical opera. As Johnson said, "All music affects me deeply. I love opera especially." His favorite was this composition called Il Trovatore by Giuseppe Verdi. He also loved Puccini, was intrigued with Wagner. He was once had a chance of being part of a production of Giuseppe Verdi's Aida, And among his favorites was also Faust, which is kind of ironic considering that Faust's story is one of hubris. And Jonson's own approach to life has often been criticized for displaying the same kind of hubris. Actor James Earl Jones, for example, who played Jonson in the film The Great White Hope, said that the Jonson story is one, like, the overarching theme of his life is hubris, is this desire to challenge the limit and dare too much and take chances that maybe one shouldn't take. Generally, hubris has a negative connotation, but at the same time, it's what makes Jack Johnson a legend, for better or worse. Johnson's intellectual side often took people by surprise. Old newspapers usually made him sound like a brute, whose only skill was violence, and whose appetites leaned toward the most primal aspects. So when people found out about this other side of Johnson's personality, usually took them by surprise. For example, a columnist for the San Francisco Bulletin wrote in a sort of racist, backhanded compliment, "With the simian slope of forehead and the thick African lips, one is taken aback by the brilliant flow of Johnson's conversation." They may have accepted his practical intelligence, demonstrated, for example, in his gaining a patent for a wrench he had invented for fixing the cars that he loved. But the artistic, cultural side of him left them puzzled. Johnson addressed this in his autobiography in the following way. He said, "A pugilist is not presumed to have high ideals. By some, he's believed to have brutish tendencies, and at best to be concerned only with material things. The possession of muscular strength and the courage to use it in contest with other men for physical supremacy does not necessarily imply a lack of appreciation for the finer and better things in life. Brutish qualities and base inclinations are prevalent in all classes. A man's vocation is no measure of his inner feelings, nor a guarantee of his earnest desire to live right and attain the highest standards." This speech and the sentiment behind it are sort of Jack Johnson being a bit of a Taoist there. You know, we're so used to people being one thing and one thing only, either nerds or athletes, either sensitive or strong, that Johnson's ability to be several things at the same time confused lots of people. You know, it's okay to be a boxer, and it's okay to be somewhat of an intellectual, but to be both at the same time just didn't make sense. It's okay, usually people understand it if you are one thing. When you put together in the same personalities things that people are not used to seeing going together, usually lots of humans don't know what to make of you. And that definitely was the case with Jack Johnson. In order to afford some of his more expensive hobbies, which is to say pretty much all of his hobbies, since he loves spending money, Johnson cashed in on his fame and joined a traveling circus to do feats of strength, joke around, do a demonstration of boxing, sing songs, dance, play music, tell stories, making in this process within a week more than the average worker made in a whole year. Despite this tremendous financial success, even in this kind of a business, even in the entertainment business, Johnson was not allowed to change in the same changing rooms used by white people. He ran into discrimination just about at every other corner. And also, you know, this is where sometimes the stories got wild. You know, in this one occasion, he threatened to kill a theater owner who didn't pay him the full amount for his show. You know, the kind of standard things that you would imagine in that kind of business made more extreme by Johnson's personality and his physical skills. While Johnson was lining up his pockets in this way, forces were at work to bring him down.
there was a strong wave of white desire to re-establish proper order. And what that meant is a context in which white people would dominate. As it applied to boxing, this would mean finding a way to get rid of him and get, again, a white guy to be the heavyweight champion in boxing. So promoters were desperate to find a white challenger. This is where the idea, even the term, you know, it's still somewhat popular, you hear of it to this day, the term the Great White Hope. That's when the term was born. Is the idea when all boxing promoters throughout the country were busy trying to find any white guy who would have a shot at beating Jack Johnson and restore the honor of white people everywhere. Johnson loved this. He loved having all these moderately skilled white boxers sent after him, because he would just destroy all of them. In one match, Johnson didn't even bother sitting down in between the rounds. This gave him a great excuse to stay away from rematches against tough black boxers, such as Sam Langford, Joe Jeanette, and Sam McVay. He had beaten all of them already, but these were very tough fighters, and there was always a chance at losing against them. Plus, they would usually pay a lot less for one black fighter to fight another black fighter. There was much more money fighting white guys, since white people would pay in the hope to see him get defeated by one of their own, or so they hoped, whereas they really wouldn't pay to see him against another black boxer. So it made obvious sense to keep fighting white boxers, making more money against people of lesser skill, because the reality of the heavyweight championship scenario at this time was that most of the white boxers were not quite as skilled as some of the black ones, rather than fight more dangerous opponents for less money. As Johnson said, "I gave Langford, Jeanette, and those boys a chance before I was champ." So the meaning was, from now on, I'm just cashing in fighting white guys for a while. He had a fight in British Columbia, winning a decision over the Irish Victor McLaglen, who later won an Academy Award as an actor. This is probably the only case ever of an Academy Award winner to have ever fought for the heavyweight championship in boxing. He also fought former light heavyweight champion Jack O'Brien. O'Brien didn't like Johnson, and black people in general, but needed the money, and so Johnson enjoyed forcing him to come to a black neighborhood in Pittsburgh to meet with him and sign the deal. For once, he would enjoy having white people having to play by his rules. And even in this case with O'Brien, Johnson didn't even bother training and just coasted through an easy match without even trying too hard. In 1909, he fought against a huge opponent, a guy named Al Kaufman, in California. Johnson actually liked Kaufman, but was annoyed when the crowd kept yelling, "Go Al, kill the nigger." So he cracked Kaufman really hard right away. He just hit him with a big right hand, and after that he yelled at the crowd, "You see what I can hand out? Now are you going to keep quiet?" The meaning being, basically, look, I can knock out this guy anytime. Unless you guys hate him, just keep it down and don't anger me, so I can let him survive a fight with me. And so that's exactly how it played out. Rather than crushing Kaufman, as it probably could have done fairly easily, he remained content to defeat him on points without hurting him too badly. After running out of white guys to beat up among the heavyweights, Johnson fought against the middleweight champion, Stanley Ketchell. Ketchell was an amazing fighter, but he was at least 25 pounds, possibly up to 35 pounds, smaller than Johnson, and he was 3 inches shorter. Now, yes, he was known as a truly scary guy. At only 12 years old, he had found the body of his father with his throat cut from ear to ear. His mother had died shortly thereafter, so Stanley had become a hobo orphan, carving a livelihood for himself within a very tough world. Some writers wrote this about him. They said, "A face like that cannot be manufactured by makeup artists. To find such a face, search the insane asylums or the prison death house." That paints a picture right there, doesn't it? Writer Dan Morgan said, "Ketchel was an exception to the human race. He was a savage. He would pound and rip his opponent's eyes, nose, and mouth in a clinch. He couldn't get enough blood. His nickname, the Assassin, fit him like a glove." Some of his other nicknames were the Wolverine, the Michigan Wildcat, or the Michigan Assassin. He liked women pretty much as Jack Johnson did. He was cocky, like Jack Johnson. He would wire telegraphs to friends saying he won a match before the match even began. Much like Johnson, he loved gambling and racing cars. But it was clear that as tough as Ketchel was, there was no way he could beat the much bigger Johnson. So, for example, in the lead-up to the fight, they took photos when Ketchel would wear boots with a 4-inch heel, and he would be dressed in a heavy overcoat, which would make him look a lot bigger than he was. His manager, in order to sell the fight, he would invite the press to see him work out, and he would make sure that Ketchel would drop 2 or 3 heavyweight sparring partners, making it look like he really had a shot, when in reality obviously didn't. The understanding there was that Johnson and Ketchel would just fight easy and get paid. Kind of a fixed fight. Now, Johnson would say not really a fixed fight. As he said, there's a great difference between a fix and a deal. Let me try to explain what Johnson means by that. A fix is you make someone win who would not win otherwise. That's a fixed fight. You know, you're changing the outcome of a fight. A deal, in Johnson's definition, is that you let the guy who would win 100% of the time, he'll still win, but you're gonna do it with the understanding that he's not gonna do too much damage to the opponent, and the opponent is not gonna try too hard to make the fight too difficult. So, you know, the guy who's supposed to win is still gonna win, the better guy will win, but they do it in a way where they are more putting on a sparring show than they are really trying to knock each other's head off. Ketchel's manager had said to Johnson, "Let's be practical, Jack. We all know you can murder Ketchel. I'm not kidding myself. I wouldn't let him get into the ring with you for $1 million unless I had your word that you wouldn't hurt him." So, okay, obviously Johnson was superior, so they would just put a good show and leave it at that. The plan was to make it last for the whole 20 rounds this fight was scheduled for, so they could make money with the royalties from people going to watch the fight in local theaters, because, you know, they would, beside the revenue generated by people attending the event live, they would also make some money by selling the footage to be shown in theaters, and people would go watch the fight. Now, people would only go watch the fight in theaters if it was a real fight. If there was nobody would pay a full price ticket to walk in, watch a 30-second fight with a quick KO. So the idea was, we'll let it last 20 rounds and make some more money that way. Johnson said, I'm quoting from his autobiography, "I decided that I would take him along for several rounds and let him make a good showing, so that the spectators would not tire of the fight." During all the early rounds, Johnson showed his technical skills, slipping everything that Ketchel threw his way. He would make Ketchel look good by still, you know, not hurting him, keeping him in the fight, occasionally letting him hit him with something, but he was clearly not trying to hurt him, just doing enough to win each round by a comfortable enough margin. A ringsider described the action as a struggle between a demon and a gritty little dwarf, which
I find an hilarious description of the match. In the 12th round, however, Ketchel went off script. In a clear indication that they were planning to double-cross Jack Johnson, Ketchel's manager screamed, "Now, Stanley, now!" And Ketchel immediately waited for Johnson to throw a lazy jab to crack him with a heavy right hand that dropped Johnson. That was not a good idea. Johnson got up with a big smile before the ref even began the count. Ketchel had broken their deal, so now all bets were off. Johnson was now a bit mad, and he immediately knocked out Ketchel with the very first punch after getting up. Just a single uppercut that left some of Ketchel's teeth inside Johnson's glove. In other words, he could have knocked him out at any moment of the fight, but he had chosen not to. Ketchel was out cold for quite a while. Showing the thought that there was no bad blood despite the double cross and the KO and the missing teeth, that same night, Ketchel and Johnson just went out and went gambling together, and Ketchel actually won a lot of the money that Johnson had made in the fight. They quickly became friends. I mean, this is one of the stories that you just can't make it up, right? It's like, first you have this guy setting up somewhat of a fixed fight, then one of them break the deal, the other one promptly knock him out, taking out some of his teeth, and they promptly just drink some beer together and became friends. And after this, they would often go out, hanging out, gambling, drinking, and going to brothels together. If this is not a classic manly story, I don't know what is. In his autobiography, Johnson wrote, "He was one of my best friends, and one whom I admired for his many excellent qualities." With no one coming even close to dethroning Johnson, the clamoring for Jim Jeffries to return increased. If you recall from the first part in this series, Jim Jeffries was the undefeated heavyweight champion, was a white guy, which helped a lot in this particular story, and he was a monster. He was a big guy, much like Johnson, actually even heavier than Johnson was. He was very powerful, KO'd most of his opponent. So he was a boxing legend who had decided to retire undefeated. And so in a context in which no other white boxer seemed to have even a chance to beat Johnson, you can see why people started whispering initially and then saying it louder and louder how badly they wanted Jeffries to come back. Initially, when people had questioned Jeffries, inviting him to return to the ring, he had been quite emphatic, saying that he didn't want to. A journalist had told him, "The public may insist that you come back and defend the title." To which Jeffries replied, "The public can go to hell." And then the journalist insisted, saying, "Suppose they say you're afraid." And Jeffries replied, "They can still go to hell." On a day when he was in a better mood, Jeffries articulated his reasons for hesitating in a clearer way. He said, "I realize that I would be hailed as the greatest champion in pugilism's history. I know that it would mean more fame than ever fell to any fighter's lot, and that it would make me a rich man. But I also realize that to lose to Johnson would make me a dog. I simply won't fight unless I know I'm good enough to knock out Johnson. You don't catch Jim Jeffries losing to a colored man." This was probably Jeffries at his most honest, where he was tempted because he realized that if he pulled it off, he came back from retirement and crushed Johnson the way he had crushed all his previous opponents, he would become a god in US at that time. But he had the lingering doubt that maybe he couldn't pull it off. What if the years away from the ring weakened him? What if Johnson maybe was better than he ever had been? He wasn't sure. And so that's why he was a little sketchy about the whole thing. In other moments, however, Jeffries would be filled with self-confidence and would boast when asked what he would do if he got in the ring with Jack Johnson. He would say, "I'll put him to sleep in 3 minutes. I want to tell you, my friends, that I'm just as good a man as I ever was, and if I was to enter the ring with this so-called black champion today, I think I could lick him with one hand tied behind my back." So, in light of declarations like this, a movement built up to pressure Jeffries to return. The pressure on him had been mounting for months. Legendary writer Jack London, the author of Call of the Wild and many other amazing books, had started this pressure the moment Jack Johnson had won the title. He had written, "Jeffries must emerge from his alpha farm and remove that smile from Johnson's face. Jeff, it's up to you." So London has been the one to issue the call. And from that moment on, magazines, newspapers, just about every other person in the US who was interested in boxing had picked up that same call. The Chicago Tribune had printed a picture of a little blonde girl with the caption, "Please, Mr. Jeffries, are you going to fight Mr. Johnson?" Jeffries started receiving hundreds of letters at his farm, all of them begging him to fight Jack Johnson since the honor of the white race was at stake. This is, in many ways, it has a touch of Roman history, this story. There's a famous tale, possibly part mythological, part historical, who knows exactly how much of this is real history and how much it became legend, but there's a tale of Lucius Quinctius Cincinnatus, who was an ancient Roman from the early days of Roman history, who had retired to farm his fields. He had retired from public life after many years of service, and he had decided to come out of retirement to save the Republic in times of extreme need, before abandoning politics yet again and returning to his fields. Many people saw Jeffries in this kind of light. They thought, hey, nobody else can bring Johnson down. You are the only one who's able to. You know, you're now a farmer, we get it, but please come back, put the gloves on one more time, and pull off the miracle that we're all praying for. You are the only one who can do it. There is that kind of Obi-Wan, our only hope type of vibe to this story. So as time went on, and as the letters kept pouring in, Jeffries' determination not to come back to fight began to erode. Eventually he went to a spa in Bohemia, which was the former Czechoslovakia at this time, to some mineral baths just to start losing weight, training a little, and test to see if he could bring himself back to fighting shape. While he was there, he met King Edward VII, the King of England, who wished him luck for the upcoming fight if he decided to take it. So by the time he returned to the States, Jeffries was ready to train. He enlisted the services of catch wrestling champion Martin Farmer Burns, who's an absolute icon of catch wrestling. He hired him as his conditioning coach for strength and conditioning, and Burns pulled off miracles getting Jeffries back into shape, which was no easy task, because Jeffries had ballooned to over 300 pounds in the meantime, so they wanted him to lose at least probably about 50 to 70 pounds to be back where he was supposed to be. He also enlisted the services of former champion James Corbett. So in a matter of months, he started shedding the weight, getting his muscle back, getting his wind back. And by the time he was in decent fighting shape, he sent shockwaves throughout the nation when he announced that he would make his return after all. Now, part of the reasons for coming back was obviously, you know, one of the biggest reasons was financial appeal. The numbers that were thrown around for what could be offered to Jeffries for these fights were insane by the standards of the times. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 were to be split between the winner and the losers, plus He would have the movie rights, which would also bring even more money, plus $10,000 each upon signing. This is equivalent to millions of dollars of today. The most money ever in boxing up until that point. But the financial appeal was only part of the story. Jeffries wanted the money, sure, but he also began believing his own mythology. He began believing that he was, after all, the white man's redeemer. This paragraph from the New York Times tells a lot about how many people were feeling having a black man as the heavyweight champion. Here is what the New York Times said. Even those who have an absurdly exaggerated horror of prize fighting as a brutal sport should gently warm in their sensitive minds a little hope that the white man may not lose, while the rest of us will wait in open anxiety the news that he has leaked the, well, since it must be in print, let us say the Negro, even though it is not the first word that comes to the tongue's tip. Wow, this was the New York Times, you know. Talk about some serious racism there. And still the New York Times, if the black man wins, thousands and thousands of his ignorant brothers will misrepresent his victory as justifying claims to much more than physical equality with their white neighbors. So, partially all of this pressure convinced Jeffrey that he was truly a Superman who couldn't be defeated. He would come back, give the public what they wanted, and retire a hero. Jeffrey seemed to agree in some of his pre-fight, as the hype was building up in some of his interviews. He said, "I'm going into this fight for the sole purpose of proving that a white man is better than a Negro." Let's try that again. This is Jim Jeffries. "I'm going into this fight for the sole purpose of proving that a white man is better than a Negro." So, here you got it from the horse's mouth. This was a lot more than a boxing fight. This was not just a match or a sporting event. This was really the ultimate test for the very idea of white supremacy. And the racial angle kept being played up over and over and over again in media. One newspaper published a cartoon showing Jack Johnson looking more like an ape than a man, while Jeffries was a real man, so he would win. Another article published said that the brain of the white man was superior to the brain of a black man, so Jeffries would certainly be able to use strategy to defeat Jack Johnson. So here you have a boxing match between two individuals being elevated to the testing grounds for superiority of Anglo-Saxon civilization. This was, again, not just a fight. This was the very symbol of racial conflict for bragging rights on manhood. The Chicago Tribune explicitly stated that this was a contest between the white man's hope and black peril. Their words, not mine. So this was really about either reinforcing or weakening the idea of white supremacy in the literal sense of supremacy, that white men are superior to blacks. Author Randy Roberts had this to say: "Quite conceivably, there had never been a more important athletic event in American history." And I really don't think he's exaggerating. It was that big of a deal in the minds of most people at the time. News about this upcoming fight escaped the sport pages and became mainstream national news. Pretty much everyone in the nation had heard about the fight, and even abroad, in many parts of the world, this was very well known. So by the time they start negotiating for actually making this fight happen, initially the fight was supposed to take place in San Francisco. But the problem is that the religious preachers had been campaigning for quite a while to ban boxing because of its brutality. So now the same reformers began pressuring California governor to ban the one match in modern history that was attracting the most attention. Thousands of letters were coming in to the governor of California saying, "Stop the fight, it's the 20th century." Initially, the promoter of this fight saw this as good news, since it would add to the publicity, it would draw more attention. But the pressure got really heavy. 50 ministers gathered outside the state capitol to pray that the governor would ban the fight. Which is kind of funny that they would protest the moral depravity of prize fighting, but they were never similarly, you know, there were no similar outrage protests about the prevalence of lynching at this time. Tells you a little bit about priorities. The governor had already approved the fight, but by now was beginning to sweat it. Not only because the moral reformers commanded lots of votes, but also because he had been told that allowing the fight would reduce the chances for San Francisco to score, becoming the site for the 1915 Panama Pacific Exposition, which would bring even more money to the state than this fight would, simply because it would last for 3 weeks rather than just one day. And since the way to get to a politician's heart is always through their pockets, it worked. So the governor said, clearly this fight is not a legal boxing exhibition, but it's a prize fight, and that's illegal. So I'm writing a letter to my own attorney generals, and in the letter the governor wrote, I quote, "The whole business is demoralizing to the youth of our state, corrupts public morals, is offensive to the senses of the great majority of our citizens, and should be abated as a public nuisance and the offenders punished." This is obviously a politician making up a pretend moral outrage to mask that the reason for this was all about business. He had already approved the fight before, and the only reason why he changed his mind was because he started seeing some possible economic problems. So all this, demoralizing to the youth of our state, offensive, blah, 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 this is all smoke and mirrors. You know, the reality is that there were economic interests that he wasn't about to lose by allowing this fight. So in either case, he revoked the permit for the fight in California, which was kind of a messed up thing to do, considering that this was only 3 weeks before the fight. They had already invested tons of money to build a special stadium for the occasion and had already sold 25,000 tickets. So now, at the last minute, the promoter had to find a new venue within just a few days. He chose Reno, Nevada, because the mayor there told him that a venue could be set up just in time. The moment it was announced that the fight had switched to Reno, the same kind of pressure that had been unleashed toward the governor of California was also began to be applied to the governor of Nevada, Governor Dickerson. You know, they told him, please cancel the fight, but unlike his Californian colleague, he refused to listen. The only thing he required from the promoter was that he wanted an assurance that this fight was not fixed. That's all he cared about. Not only he would let the fight happen, but he even visited the training camps where he saw Bo Jeffries and Jack Johnson. In one occasion when he visited the Johnson camp, he saw him spar with his former rival and now training partner Al Kaufman. After this visit, the governor said, I quote, "I've never seen a man who can whip Jack Johnson as he stands today, and I'm forced to bet on him." This stance by the governor didn't go well with a lot of the moral reformer. Reverend Boynton was a Baptist minister, had this to say. There should be some way by which our nation could recall the charter of a state that has become a desert and a moral menace. Nevada has no right to remain a part of our nation. Wow, all of this because the governor was allowing a boxing fight? Phew. This protest wasn't just about boxing. The protest was also motivated by a lot of people being scared about the possibility of a black guy winning this fight. But Governor Dickerson was unmoved. Another issue that came up before the fight, newspapers started wondering who could be picked to ref such a politically charged match. You know, who's going to be the referee? This is going to be kind of a big deal. Some sources say that an offer was made to the British writer H.G. Wells. And offers went even to the President of the United States, William Taft. Can you imagine having the President of the United States refereeing the fight? That would have been interesting. A newspaper pitched the idea to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes. And Doyle replied in this way. He said, "I was much inclined to accept this honorable invitation. However, the distance and my engagements presented a final bar." So after all these famous names were thrown around, eventually the choice fell to George Louis Rickard. George Louis Rickard was the promoter for this fight. And again, much like the way Johnson had done for his previous championship fight, this one was agreeing to having the promoter being the ref was because he knew that the promoter did not want to take a chance and blatantly favor one guy over another, and then there would be all sort of repercussions regarding his reputation as a fair promoter and all of that. So it would probably be the best bet to have a fair referee. The date was set for July 4th, 1910. So as the day was coming close, 15 special trains pulled into Reno, Nevada, just to carry the immense amount of people wanting to come to see the fight. A ring was set up just for the occasion in downtown. People from all over US, including notorious bank robber Cincinnati Slim, and a certain Juan Lett, who was renowned as the Hatchet Man for the Hip Sing Tong, a Chinese gang for which Lett was their hitman. You know, he was reputed to have killed between 20 or 30 people in this. He was also in attendance. Reno was packed with more people than they had room for. There were twice as many visitors than there were inhabitants in town. People slept outdoors, people slept on pool tables, in train cars, all over the place. The city for the next few days became a pickpocket's paradise. Streets were literally covered with wallets that had been stolen, emptied of money, and thrown away. Overwhelmingly, all these people coming into Reno were white males, there to see Jim Jeffries take the title back from Jack Johnson. Everyone had bought into the Jeffries mythology and expected him to crush Johnson. So Jeffries was the heavy betting favorite. Most boxing analysts had kept repeating that Jeffries would win. Even black boxers believed this. Joe Jeanette, who had fought against Johnson, said, "Jeffries can lose half of his strength, have his endurance cut in two, carry a ton of extra weight, and still whip Johnson." Burns stated that Johnson was only good against smaller opponents, but that Jeffries would crush him. The journalist Arthur Roll wrote how Fitzsimmons had hit Jeffries with blows that could kill a man, but Jeffries had just shaken them off. And he also added, "The Negro might be a clever boxer, but he has never been up against a real fighter before. He has a yellow streak. And anyway," now referring to Jeffries, "let's hope he kills the coon." Whew, again, talk about some crazy quotes there. Let's hope he kills the coon. That's the reporting coming in from Reno. In Reno, there were about 500 journalists, mostly writing about how Jeffries would win and redeem white people's honor. Over 1 million words a day were being published about the fight in the days right before. That's the equivalent of about 12 novels being written every day. Among the journalists there was Jack London, who had showed up for his reporting duties with his face bruised from a fight he had with a bartender in Utah on the way to Nevada. London was super excited to be there, saying that there had never been anything like this in the history of boxing. And London himself, as we saw, played a huge role in making this fight happen. You know, he's the guy who, after all, had suggested that Jeffries should come out of retirement the moment Johnson had won the title. Throughout the nation, people were going wild. Some black churches were holding prayer services for Johnson, while white churches were doing the same thing for Jeffries. Gambling parlors were receiving bets from anywhere from England to China, from India to the Philippines. This was a true international event at a time before the internet, you know, before we had the internet, before TV, even before radio. Which is insane, because, you know, back then the speed at which you could travel, the speed at which information could travel was so incredibly slower than it is today. Then for one fight taking place in Reno, Nevada, to suddenly have this huge international appeal was almost unheard of. Johnson, despite all this pressure, was super confident in himself. He even went out and bet $20,000 on his own victory. And he sent a telegram to his brother Charles. The message was quick, but unambiguous. He said, "Bet your last copper on me." Now, despite his confidence, there were a few things that probably crossed Johnson's mind. Rumors were floating that gunmen in the audience would shoot Johnson if he won. Governor Dickerson, when he stopped by to visit with Johnson, asked him about the assassination rumors, and he was told that Johnson was not worried. Despite this, the governor said, "You know, just to play safe, I'm going to put 5 state rangers to keep an eye on your training camp, to keep an eye, you know, making sure that nobody would shoot you." Proving that, in that sense, the governor is an interesting example, because, you know, we're seeing this story as a white versus black tale. It is and it's not, because clearly not all white people treated Jack Johnson the same. The governor actually treated him very well and wanted him to have a fair chance. Johnson didn't believe the rumors that somebody was out to assassinate him, but he was still kind of unnerving. And just to play safe, Johnson slept with a gun by his bed, and his friend Cal McVeigh had a shotgun on hand at all times, and he would patrol the place where Johnson would train constantly with his shotgun in hand. Partially out of fear of racist attacks, partially out of fear of robbers. Johnson also told the tale, saying that somebody had tried to poison him. His friend, Frank Sutton, would always switch glasses with him to avoid anything being slipped to Johnson to try to influence the outcome of the fight. And in one occasion, after switching glasses with Johnson, Sutton got super sick and was messed up for months afterwards. Something that people believe was consistent with low-grade poisoning. Others suggest that this wasn't poisoning, but someone had just played a prank on Sutton. We have no idea, of course. We don't know which one is correct. We do know that Sutton drank something that was supposed to go to Johnson and got really sick. That's all we know. In Johnson's camp, there were several former opponents who had become his friends. The closest one was probably Stanley Ketchell. We just spoke about the fight between Johnson and Ketchel just a few minutes ago. If you recall, Ketchel was that same middleweight champion defeated by Johnson in a previous match. And after their fight, we said how the two of them had become great friends. Ketchel would die just a few months later at 26 years old, shot in the back by the husband of a woman that Ketchel was sleeping with. Which seems a rather fitting ending for the wild life of Stanley Ketchel. But at this time, he was still around and he was in Jack Johnson's corner. Other sparring and training partners included Al Kaufman and several others. In his autobiography, Jack Johnson wrote about them, saying, "They made training worthwhile, and association with them was a privilege and a pleasure. Our lives in training were happy and cheerful. We had good times after some of our initial troubles and disappointments were disposed of. And I suppose that one reason that Little, Langford and others were sold on the idea that I was going to lie down was because I took life easy. I didn't worry much, and sought always to extract for myself and others whatever enjoyment life offered." Throughout his training camp, Johnson was seen to be smiling, cracking jokes. He would entertain journalists stopping by playing his bass. He would listen to love songs. He seemed really oddly relaxed. The Chicago Tribune had this to say: "Physically, the greatest athlete the colored race has produced, and mentally as keen as a razor in a sort of underdeveloped way, he fiddles away on his bull fiddle, swaps jokes with ready wit, shoots craps, plays baseball, listens dreamingly to classical love songs on the phonograph, and is going to fight Jim Jeffries for the world's championship 1 week from tomorrow." Most observers couldn't make any sense of his casual demeanor despite the pressure. Pretty much everyone was talking about the match nonstop. It seemed impossible for anyone to be able to be unaffected by that kind of pressure the way Johnson was. Reporters just couldn't understand his degree of relaxation. They said he seemed oblivious, as if he didn't feel any hint of nervousness. And so they came up with their own interpretations. The San Francisco Examiner said this, that because he was, quote-unquote, essentially African, Johnson feels no deeper than the moment, sees no farther than his nose, and is incapable of anticipation. The same cheerful indifference to coming events has marked others of the race, even while standing in the very shadow of the gallows. Their stolid unconcern baffled all who beheld it. They were to be hanged, they knew it. But having no fancy, no imagination, they could not anticipate. And adding to the same point, they wrote, "Johnson is safe in his soul shallowness and lack of imagination." So that was their interpretation. Johnson is safe in his soul shallowness and lack of imagination. In other words, even when blacks demonstrated unflinching bravery, it was still somehow proof of their inferiority. It's not that they were tough as hell in the face of being about to be hanged, as in the story that the San Francisco Examiner tells. It's that the only reason why they were so apparently tough is because they could not anticipate the future. They had no imagination, as he puts it. The reason why Johnson was able to be so relaxed is essentially because he was stupid. He couldn't think ahead. That was the Examiner interpretation. Jack London similarly suggested that Johnson was unable to think about the future and was stuck in the present moment, which sounds like an insult and possibly was meant that way, but is actually kind of a compliment. Because here is the truth. The worst thing you could possibly do before a fight is letting your mind wander, because it will drive you crazy. I very much speak from experience on this. Anytime I ever fought, I was always the exact opposite of Johnson. I would hardly sleep for days beforehand. I would be nervous. My mind would constantly be on the upcoming match. And, you know, mentally I was kind of a wreck. Sometimes I did well because of my technique or because of training, but from a mental standpoint, not precisely because I would let my mind wander too much. But then there are other people who are clearly can handle the pressure way better than I can ever dream of. And way better than apparently even the folks from the San Francisco Examiner or everybody else thought it was normal to be able to handle. I'll give you guys an example. The lady a few feet away from me right now, the producer and editor of History on Fire, Savannah M., man, talk about somebody who's a natural fighter. And the point I'm making is because this reminds me so much of Jack Johnson. So let me give you like a super quick story about this. First time when she made her pro debut in MMA, you know, it's a very stressful environment. You're about to get into a cage or to get into this fight with somebody about to try to take your head off. Everybody in the back, everybody in the locker room is all stressed out and tense, and you see people going out to fight before you and they come back all bloodied up, and in the meantime they are telling you, hey, get ready, start wrapping your hands because you're next. And you know, everybody can get nervous in the face of something like this. You know, it's almost impossible not to. And she was an absolute, like, she could have been sitting at home on a couch and she would have looked the same, just zero pressure, eerily relaxed. Now, it gets even weirder. Before her second fight, she just took a nap. I mean, I couldn't sleep for days before a fight. She would literally lay down and took a nap, probably 2 hours ahead. Slept for a good hour, then somebody would come in, say, hey, wake up, time to get ready. She would just pop back up from her nap, stretch out a little, and get ready to go into the cage. How? I mean, I don't get it. You know, I really don't understand that degree of that ability, which apparently was exactly the same kind of ability that Jack Johnson was displaying and was puzzling everybody. That ability to be completely calm and relaxed before a big event where not only is it scary from the standpoint of physical safety, that yes, you may have somebody who's going to try to punch your head off, but it's also scary in terms of pressure. You know, oh, everybody's eyes are on you. And again, some people are clearly better at handling this than others. So yes, in this particular case, even Jack Johnson's incredible ability to keep this cool under pressure was turned into a negative racial stereotype by his detractors. According to them, he wasn't calm because he was tough as hell. He was calm because he had no imagination and was unable to think about the future. Jeffries, on the other hand, couldn't bring himself to eat dinner the night before the fight. And according to later interviews with those in his camp, he spent good part of the night pacing back and forth in his room. He was feeling the pressure. He was feeling the fear that he may fail to live up to popular expectations. The Inter-Ocean had said of him, I quote, "Under his skin of bronze, the muscles rippled like the placid surface of a body of water touched by a gentle breeze." But Jeffries was not moved by the poetry with which writers described him. Actually, this kind of writings got him even edgier. The more he read how invincible he was supposed to be, the more restless he grew. And he was also fairly disturbed by the fact that his longtime former manager and trainer, Billy Delaney, had publicly announced he was sure Jack Johnson would win, and even went so far as to visit Johnson to give him advice. Jeffries commented, "To think of Delaney being with the nigger instead of me, And then he would just shake his head and walk away. The morning of the fight, Jeffries put on a brave face and declared, "When the gloves are knotted on my hands and I stand ready to defend what is really my title, it will be at the request of the public, which forced me out of retirement. I realize full well what depends on me, and I'm not going to disappoint the public. That portion of the white race that has been looking to me to defend its athletic supremacy may feel assured that I'm fit to do my very best." But he also added, "If Johnson defeats me, I will shake his hand and declare him the greatest fighter the sporting world has ever known." He also addressed the rumors about people wanting to kill Jack Johnson in no uncertain terms. He said, "I would consider any move to intimidate Johnson as cowardly and a disgrace to the American spirit of fair play. I expect to whip him. If Johnson should by any chance win, though, he must not be harmed. I demand this." Johnson similarly made a statement expecting victory, but equally willing to congratulate the opponent if he were to be defeated. And so here we were, on July 4th, 1910, America held its collective breath. What Jack London called the greatest confrontation in the history of combat sports was about to begin. This wasn't going to be simply the biggest boxing match ever. No one had any illusions that this was just about sports. This was a fight for the soul of the United States. 20,000 spectators were in attendance, including some women sitting in separate special curtain boxes. 30,000 people stood outside of the New York Times offices waiting to hear the results. Many people gathered outside the offices of other newspapers to similarly wait for news, which would be arriving via telegraph from Reno. African-American leader Booker T. Washington didn't really like Jack Johnson, but he had a system set up to receive news as soon as possible. The Kansas City Star had rented a large hall for 14,000 people who would listen to an announcer using a megaphone giving a blow-by-blow account of the fight from telegraph news sent from ringside. Think, this is only a little over 100 years ago. You know, in the days of the internet, we would laugh at this, but imagine 14,000 people paying tickets to go into a place where a guy with a megaphone would start screaming the blow-by-blow description of the fight. It's wild how much the world has changed in just a century. In Long Island, there was an exclusive club where some of the biggest bosses of American industry, from William K. Vanderbilt, Howard Gould, Lawrence Drake, and others among the richest men in the nation, would hear the news through the New York Times bulletins. In Chicago, the warden of a county jail and a trustee yelled the news of the fight as he received them so that the inmates would find out. At the Chicago Coliseum, a crowd watched some 9 feet tall electrical figures reenacting the description of what was happening in the ring. And the San Francisco Examiner hired a white and a black boxer to reenact the blow-by-blow account as they received the news. Unlike it's customary during boxing events, there were no preliminary bouts. There were no other fights that day. There was just that one fight, that's it. Just the title fight and nothing else. Because of the anonymous threats to kill Johnson if he won, policemen at the entrance would frisk everyone to check for guns in fear that Johnson would be shot. There were very few, but some black people among the spectators. The vast majority was white. And just for the sake of making Jack Johnson feel welcome, the band that climbed into the ring to play some tunes in preparation of the fight played a song entitled "All Coons Look Alike to Me" right before the fight began. Again, some of the degree of racism of the time is kind of mind-boggling today. Johnson later would say that he was aware that pretty much everybody there wanted him to lose, but that didn't disturb him. You know, thousands of hate-filled eyes were fixed on him. He had a few supporters there. Etta was there, but overwhelmingly, this was a Jeffries crowd. When Jeffries entered the ring, just a standing ovation for him. Everybody was on their feet, clapping and screaming. Jack London described his entrance in this way. He said, "When he stripped and his mighty body could be seen covered with mats of hair, all the primordial adjectives ever applied to him received their vindication. The man of iron, the grisly giant, was grim and serious. The man of summer temperament smiled and smiled." The man of summer temperament being Jack Johnson. You know, we see this juxtaposition there, you know, Jeffrey serious, tough, ready to do battle, in London's word, grim and serious. And Jack Johnson always smiling. The respective corners were mad-dogging each other. Former champion Jim Corbett, who helped train Jeffries, stated he didn't like Johnson because he believed he was not only as good as a white man, but better than a white man. So Corbett said, "Take it from me. The black boy has a yellow streak," which in the language of the time, meaning he was a coward. You know, today not too many people use "as a yellow streak" to say that someone is a coward, but that's how he was typically, you know, very common sentence used back then. So he said, "Take it from me, the black boy has a yellow streak, and Jeff will bring it out when it gets him into the ring." Legendary wrestler and Jeffrey's strength and conditioning coach, Farmer Burns, was in the corner too. Johnson was possibly a bit bitter at seeing Joe Chowinski. Joe had been Jack's old mentor, who had taught him the finer points of defensive boxing after their match. If you recall from the first episode of this series, Chowinski and Johnson had spent almost a month together in jail for participation in an illegal prize fight, and Chowinski had taught him all the tricks of the trade. But now Chowinski was in Jeffrey's corner. Another guy that Johnson may have felt betrayed by was George Little, Johnson's former manager, who had switched side and had even bet against his former friend. They had a falling out during training camp over a poker game, and they parted ways. Little had gone to Jeffrey's camp to give him all the info he could possibly give about the details of Jack Johnson's training, and his betting on Jeffrey's convinced many people to do the same. The fight was going to be fought outdoors under the sun at 2:30 p.m. I don't know who thought this was a good idea, because in Reno, Nevada on July 4th at 2:30 p.m. in 1910 was 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Whew, that's some heavy, crazy heat right there. I mean, in 110 degrees, I don't know about you guys, I feel like my brain start oozing out of my ears and all I'm looking for is a place to pass out. The idea of climbing into the ring in front of 20,000 people to fight for the heavyweight championship, that's something else. I mean, forget fighting, just sitting in the audience at 110 Fahrenheit would be incredibly unpleasant. Fighting in those conditions, I mean, if it's a torture for the audience, you can only imagine what it felt for the two men actually fighting it out under those circumstances. Johnson was introduced as the colored heavyweight champion of the world, while Jeffries was introduced as the champion of champions, the great unbeaten white champion of the world. As they stood in the ring, listening to the referee giving the last minute instructions, Jeffries refused to shake hands. Johnson didn't want to either. Randy Roberts wrote the following: "Not to observe such a fundamental ritual, the very expression of sportsmanship and fair play, indicated that this was not simply another championship fight." And finally, after all this waiting, the bell rang and the match began. As soon as the match began, Jeffries charge forward, attacking. A couple of rounds were spent with Jeffries attacking, and Johnson's great defensive skill preventing Jeffries' brawling style from being effective. You know, neither guy was dominating, neither one was doing anything impressive. Jeffries' strength was the stuff of legends, and no one dared to clinch with him, because popular wisdom held that there wasn't a fighter in the world who could handle his strength in close quarters. And yet, Johnson was known as a technical master of the clinch. He would typically use this position to control his opponent's arms, while briefly breaking away, hitting him, and going back to controlling his arms. Johnson used these to, you know, this skill that he had in the clinch basically allowed him to hit opponents without being hit. So the question was, what would happen when these two masters of the clinch would meet? Jeffries had a substantial weight advantage. He came in at 227 pounds against the 280 pounds of Jack Johnson. So he was 19 pounds heavier. That's a lot. But Johnson was not intimidated by Jeffries' reputation for strength or by the weight difference. On the contrary, he intentionally went into the lion's cave and looked for the clinch. The result of the first encounters in the clinch was not encouraging for Jeffries' supporters. Every time they did clinch, it was Johnson who controlled the action and pushed Jeffries across the ring. Over and over, Jeffries' blows went nowhere, and they would end up in the clinch. In Johnson's telling, I quote, "Hardly had a blow been struck when I knew that I was Jeff's master." Early on, a spectator was heard screaming, "He'll kill you, Jack," to which Jack Johnson replied, "Yeah, that's what they all say." After three rounds of fairly inconclusive action, Jeffries landed a heavy right to the body and a left that opened a cut in Johnson's mouth. Johnson landed a big overhand in round four and also started finding a home for his trademark uppercut. Johnson would later say that his confidence grew after that because he started feeling Jeffries' spirit breaking. In addition to fighting Jeffries, Johnson was busy in having a verbal fight with former champion Jim Corbett, who was in Jeffries' corner, and kept screaming racial insults and trying to provoke him. Oddly enough, Johnson had been a big admirer of Jim Corbett, but clearly the admiration wasn't mutual, since the former champ used every insult in the book to get under Johnson's skin. Randy Roberts refers to Jim Corbett as the most vocal racist in Jeffries' corner. Roberts writes, "He hated all blacks, but Johnson more than the rest. And he had a theory that blacks became useless fighters when enraged. Therefore, from the earliest rounds, he screamed insults at Johnson. But they did not have the desired effect. Instead of making Johnson angry, the insults seemed to have a calming effect." You know, Johnson had heard all the insults before, and he knew all these white people speaking the insulting words were afraid. Afraid of what he was capable of. They were afraid of him. The more calm and polite Johnson was, the more he smiled, and the more Corbett went crazy, you know. When Corbett called Johnson a coward for his choosing to fight in the clinch, to this, Johnson, while in the clinch with Jeffries, replied back, "I'm just fighting like you did, Mr. Corbett," because Corbett himself had been famous for his emphasis on defensive techniques. So Johnson started playing this game where every time he would hit Jeffries, he would grin at the corner at Corbett. He actually told him to, "Hey, why don't you come into the ring?" He said he invited him into the ring, suggesting that the fight may be more balanced if he were to fight against Corbett and Jeffries at the same time. In round 12, as Corbett was getting red-faced and started spitting when he spoke, Johnson taunted him, saying, "I thought you said you were going to have me wild." you know, while he was perfectly calm while Courbet was going crazy. Johnson's verbal taunts were not limited to driving Courbet crazy, they were also aiming at sapping Jeffries' confidence. He would talk to Jeffries throughout the fight, saying things like, "How do you like it, Jim? I can do this all afternoon. How do you feel, Jim? Does this hurt?" Courbet and others in the corner were desperately trying to motivate Jeffries with their best inspirational speeches and reminding him how much depended on him. In his own corner, Johnson was just relaxing. By the end of the 14th round, Jeffries' nose was broken, his eyes were almost shut, and he was covered in blood. Even Courbet stopped talking at this point. In the 15th round, while they were in the clinch, Johnson landed a big right uppercut and three left hands in a row, while Jeffrey turned away, and for the first time in his career, Jeffrey was dropped to the mat. He had never been knocked down before. He got up, and Johnson hit him again halfway out of the ring. They counted him again, he managed to get up, and for the third time, Johnson dropped him to the mat. So by this point, Jeffrey's corner decided to quit the fight before the ref can count him out. Jack Johnson's corner immediately created a protective ring around their fighter to protect him, to avoid, you know, checking on the room. Was anybody ever really going to shoot him? What was going to... The fight was finally over. Johnson had done the impossible. He had knocked out former champion Jim Jeffrey, the undefeated, the great white hope, all the hyperbolic statements. He had gone down. So Johnson tried to walk toward Jeffries to shake hands, but Jeffries' seconds didn't let him close. The crowd began leaving the stadium in stunned silence. This was Jim Jeffries' only loss in his career. Soon after the match was over, Jeffries admitted that Jack Johnson was better than he had ever been. Even at his best, he couldn't have beaten him. He said, "I could have never whipped Johnson at my best. I couldn't have hit him. No, I couldn't have reached him in 1,000 years. Another former champion, John Sullivan, stated, "Scarcely has there ever been a championship contest that was so one-sided. He played fairly at all times and fought fairly," referring to Johnson. "He's one of the craftiest, cunningest boxers that has ever stepped into the ring. The best man won, and I was one of the first to congratulate him." So now, Johnson was the undisputed champion of the world. And Jack London stated the obvious by saying about Johnson, "He has not the yellow streak." Yeah, I think by now Johnson had proved he definitely wasn't a coward. In Chicago, Jack Johnson's mom had been at the Peking Theater listening to the live bulletins of the fight, and when news of his victory arrived, the crowd lifted her on their shoulders and carried her out in triumph. People in the streets were banging pots, chanting, "Jack, Jack, Jack, Jack." She said, "I knew he would do it. There were 80 million people against him today, but he beat all of them. If his father had only lived to see it. It's certainly grand to be the mother of a real hero." Lots of people were a little less thrilled with the news. After the fight, Jack, Etta, and some of his entourage took a train back to Chicago, and they started receiving news of riots breaking out between black people celebrating the victory and white people trying to crush them. The riots following the fights were in many ways similar to the kind of riots that broke out when Martin Luther King was killed, all over the United States. All in all, that night there would be riots in 25 states in 50 different cities. Race riots took place in every single southern state and some northern ones too. Some started because of black people attacking those whites were talking trash about Johnson. Most of them started when white people would attack black people celebrating. On a street cart in Houston, Texas, a certain Charles Williams was celebrating Jack Johnson's victory. A white man didn't like to hear about it, so he cut his throat. In Pennsylvania, a 9-year-old girl was killed by a bullet fired by black people into a white crowd. In Georgia, white men opened fire on a black construction crew, killing 3 people. In West Virginia, some white people saw a black man driving a car, so they dragged him out and hanged him. Police rescued a black guy about to be lynched in Manhattan. Still in Manhattan, white people set a black apartment building on fire and tried blocking the doors so no one could get out. A mob of 3,000 people in New York went out looking for any black person they could find to beat them up. All in all, that night, hundreds of people would be injured. Quite a few would die. Some sources say 11 people died, some sources say 18, some say 26, somewhere around there. No one knows for sure how many died. Possibly 20, 30, again, there are all sorts of estimates. We do know that there were over 200 people wounded. In Utah, the train wagon where Johnson was traveling was attacked by 3 guys, but they were kept at bay by railroad cops. Besides the violence, another response to Jack Johnson's victory was a backlash against boxing as a whole. Author Phineas Farr writes the following. He said, "Much of the disappointment and resentment over Jeffrey's defeat took the form of denouncing the entire affair as an outbreak of brutality." Jack London in the Daily Telegraph wrote, "The days of the ring are over. Whatever glories it once possessed have vanished. The Reno encounter was deplorable, not only because it was disgusting, but because it aggravated the color problem." What can you say about this? I mean, I love Jack London as a writer. I think he's an amazing writer. He had a great story. There were lots of interesting insights to his personality. But come on. I mean, the quote that I just read you is shameful. That's what it is. You know, Jack London had been this big, huge fan of boxing, loved the sport, always wrote in glowing terms, and suddenly, because a black guy had proved that he was the best boxer around, crushing the best white heavyweight champion there was at this time, suddenly London is saying the days of the ring are over. Whatever glories he once possessed have vanished. Ridiculous. The LA Times addressed the racial side of the fight head-on in an article called "A Word to the Black Man." The LA Times wrote, "Do not point your nose too high. Do not swell your chest too much. Do not boast too loudly. Don't be puffed up. Let not your ambition be inordinate or take a wrong direction. Remember, you have done nothing at all. You're just the same member of society you were last week. You are on no higher plane, deserve no new consideration, and will get none. No man will think a bit higher of you, because your complexion is the same as that of the victor at Reno." Which makes you think, would they have written the same thing at Jeffrey's one? Well, we all know the answer, right? Obviously not. In Chicago, clearly, they did not read the LA Times, because in the streets there was just pure euphoria in the black community. By the time Johnson made his entry into Chicago, people were throwing flowers in his path. Thousands of African Americans were there wanting to shake his hand. It was a scene straight out of an ancient Roman triumph. A journalist wrote, "Jack Johnson came to his own with the blare of trumpets. The citizens clung to the wheels of his chariot, drew from there the horses and bore him of broad shoulders high above the shouting multitude. Not since the gladiator days of Rome has there been a scene enacted as that which greeted Johnson's return from Reno. His pathway was strewn with flowers. Rich and poor alike lost distinction in the crashing throng to seize his hand." basically they all love the bad boy who could outsmart and outfight white supremacists. They love the rebel who had flipped off a system that kept them down. For people who are reminded often in humiliating fashion of their inferior status as second-class citizens, Johnson offered vicarious satisfaction every time he dared to rise beyond what whites considered acceptable and succeeded. Johnson said, "This is nice, but I hope they'll support me also when I lose, the same way as now that I have triumphed." In the meantime, though, he enjoyed his triumph and bought a car for his mother, wired money to all his childhood friends from Galveston. That same night, a white guy with a gun would try to kill him by breaking into his house, but the cops stopped him. The fight had touched a very raw nerve with the American public. Simmering racial tensions reached a boiling point as a result of it. And more importantly, the outcome was a stunning blow to the very idea of white supremacy. If Jack Johnson could crush the best white boxers in the world, then white supremacy was just a myth. But this was not a myth most people were ready to give up. Their worldview, their very sense of identity, depended on the unshakable conviction that any member of the white race was superior to any member of darker races. Johnson had robbed them of this. Not only was he a black man, that was bad enough, but to add insult to injury, he was a defiant black man who refused to fulfill his prescribed inferior social role. He took Santa Claus away from them, and they couldn't tolerate it. So, from now on, since they couldn't beat him in the ring, they would try to do everything, legally and illegally, to stop him. And the tale of what happens next is the way we will continue our story in the third and last part of this Jack Johnson series. The next episode of History on Fire, where we'll cover the last section of the Jack Johnson story, will be available within a month. In the meantime, a couple of things I want to mention. Episodes actually come in early for people who join our Patreon at patreon.com/historyonfire at the $10 level or more. They are usually released a few days earlier on the Patreon website. Also, similarly, if you absolutely hate ads and cannot stand the idea of me giving thanks to some people who are sponsoring the show, one way to have ad-free episodes is by going to patreon.com/historyonfire and join at a $5 level. There are other perks if you join for more, access to all the back catalog and everything else, but check it out, see if it's something that you would like to join. Let me now give thanks to the people who make this show possible. Let me start this month with Flavier, who joined our list of sponsors for this month. Flavier is the world's largest online club of spirits enthusiasts. They have compiled a collection of over 15,000 spirits, and what membership with Flavier gets you is a themed tasting box that will let you try different spirits before buying a full-size bottle. You get one of these every quarter,
and you get to sample all these different spirits that are sent to you, and you decide then whether one particularly strikes your fancy and you want a full bottle of it. Also, once a month, you get access to their vault, which holds a section of rare and hard-to-find spirits available to members only. They do private bottlings, they do live events, they do all sorts of other cool stuff. So if this is something that either you like for yourself or you think you would make a great Christmas gift, check them out. They usually have a long waiting list, they still do actually, but they arrange something special for History on Fire listeners. So you can go to flaviar.com/exclusive and use the coupon code HISTORY during checkout. So again, that's flaviar.com/exclusive and use the coupon code HISTORY during checkout. This episode is also brought to you by Blue Apron, the leading meal kit delivery service in the United States. Quality of food is amazing. I've been eating Blue Apron for now over a year. And again, I'm not saying this, you know, it's easy to sound hyperbolic when somebody's sponsoring you because you feel that you have to. This is not that case. The day when Blue Apron will stop sponsoring me, I will still get Blue Apron meals all the time because I just like them a lot. They have like a two-person meal plan, they have a family meal plan. You can start and stop service anytime, you know, maybe you are on their membership list, but if you just say you don't want deliveries for whatever many weeks, you can do that and take your time and only order when you're ready. Very easy to follow recipes, really high quality. Check them out. So Blue Apron is treating History on Fire listeners to their first dinner, $30 value if you visit blueapron.com/onfire. So check out this week's menu and get $30 off with free shipping at blueapron.com/onfire. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Big shout out to Brad Harris from the How It Began podcast, A History of the Modern World. Brad holds a PhD in History of Science and Technology from Stanford University, and his podcast basically chronicles human advancements in the fields of science, technology, cultural advancements as well. Basically, he traces how humanity has evolved throughout history in various areas. There's a great episode about monumental architecture going all the way back from Stonehenge to modern-day marvels in many American cities, to one about the rise of the internet, a really cool one about how dogs have evolved from wolves as part of being in close contact with humans and selective breeding. So check it out. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you happen to listen, and check out his website at howitbegin.com. Also, big thank you to my regular sponsors who have been with me from day one, Onnit and Datsusara. You have no idea what to get some people for Christmas? Check out onnit.com/history, where you'll receive an automatic discount on Onnit products. Workout gear, amazing. Great supplements, clothing, all sorts of. For the nerdy Star Wars fans among you out there, me included, by the way, they are about to release this glorious yoga mat, which features a Frozen Han Solo in it. It's brilliant. Lots of great stuff at Onnit, so go check them out. And if you need a bag, a backpack, a computer bag, a travel bag of any kind, or if you are into martial arts and you need a jiu-jitsu uniform, go to dsgear.com. These guys have some of the absolutely best hemp gear out there. Great company, really like everything about them, so go check them out. If you didn't catch any of the above websites, the links are in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. And now I think I've spoken in your ears long enough, so I'll just leave you wishing you a very good day.